I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Jonathan Glover, in his Moral History of the 20th Century, summons up the imagery of mass human sacrifice that is all too familiar. Children decapitated with machetes in Rwanda, faces melting in Hiroshima, children lying like fried eels on the pavements of Hamburg, mountains of emaciated corpses in Nazi death camps, American soldiers in Vietnam slashing open the bellies of pregnant women. The 20th century, like none other, was marked by the justification of wholesale atrocity, which was also retail in that real people did it and kept doing it. Jonathan Glover argues what we all feel intuitively, that modern history violates a fundamental moral nature, what he calls our moral identity. So his question is, how the species came so close to losing the compass and how so many millions of people decided we could do without it. There's a lot of history in Jonathan Glover's book. It's titled Humanity, but this is a philosopher's work, so as you could guess, there are ideas at the bottom of it. Connection listeners, can we teach ourselves how not to repeat the moral disasters of the last century? And if bad ideas brought it about, what are the better ideas that will redeem the future? The phone line to Jonathan Glover's Humanity Connection is 1-800-423-8255. Are there moral models also to be rescued from the rubbish of the 20th century that might be part of that redemption? 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Jonathan Glover. This is a huge book and a huge inquiry. What made you think you could tackle it? What got you started?
Well, I've been teaching ethics and writing about ethics most of my adult life. And I went to a conference in Poland when there was still a communist government. And over lunch, I sat next to a Polish philosopher who told me the story of his life. In 1939, when the Nazis invaded, his father was a journalist and was ordered to write for a Nazi newspaper, and he refused and was shot. The person I was talking to was then aged 13 and was orphaned. He took part in the Warsaw Uprising. Many of his friends were killed. He studied philosophy in the underground university with the Gestapo rootling around outside. He went to Auschwitz. He somehow survived that. He worked as a slave laborer in the quarries in the Nazi camp in Mauthausen in Austria. He was then liberated by the American army. He then went back to Poland and taught philosophy during the Stalin years. And when I met him, still with a communist government in Poland, he'd been elected rector of the University of Warsaw, and he had been dismissed from that post by the government because he was too much of a dissident. He founded one of the discussion groups, which was a tributary, which led to the Solidarity movement. He had his passport removed. And as he told me this story, I came to think that the fact that I lived in England meant that I had missed out on many of the horrors of the 20th century. Now, of course, I'm glad to have missed out on those horrors, but I couldn't help feeling that my thinking about ethics was missing a dimension because of my lack of awareness of them. And so I resolved to really try to read a lot and learn a lot about those atrocities with the idea of looking for lessons that we could draw from them to help us in our thinking about ethics.
Just as a preface, what are the differences between a philosopher's inquiry and the lessons you want to draw and those of a historian, say?
Well, historians are interested in the careful and detailed study of particular events, looking at the interaction of many different kinds of causes, economic, social, political, and so on. I'm looking with a particular question in mind. I'm asking the question which anyone who goes to Auschwitz must ask: how is it that people were able to do these things to other people? I'm interested in that as a philosopher because I believe that the ethics that we propagate, which we try to teach to our children, should make a difference to the sort of world we live in.
You also start with the premise, and maybe you ought to just spell that out, that despite Nietzsche's God is dead or Ivan Karamazov's notion that if God is dead, everything's permissible. Despite all that, there is in us somewhere a moral impulse, a moral identity.
Yes, I believe that even without religion, even without the idea that there's an objective moral law out there that we can somehow discover by reason, we have in us psychological impulses which restrain us from doing the worst things to each other. To take a very everyday humdrum example, most people don't park in the disabled space. And if you ask why not, there are some rather selfish reasons, like I don't
very
want...
Very stiff penalties, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to get... I don't want to get a parking fine and so on. Don't want to have the neighbours see it, because it would be embarrassing. But I think there are more serious issues. There are, many of us feel we don't want a disabled person to have to lug heavy groceries a long distance. We don't feel that we want to be so mean as to take the space that's reserved for the disabled people. The idea of sympathy, the idea of respecting people's rights and their dignity, and the idea of what I want to call moral identity, the idea that we have a conception of the sort of person we want to be, or even more, the sort of person we don't want to be, these are the things that in everyday life restrain us from acts of terrible cruelty and nastiness.
Just like, why do you dismiss objective moral law at the beginning and say you've got to work this out without any of that? A lot of people haven't dismissed that.
No, I agree. A lot of people believe in religion. A lot of people believe in an objective moral law based on reason. I have two reasons for the strategy I've adopted. One is that I'm a skeptic myself personally about both religion and objective moral law. But second, since the world contains both people who believe in objective morality and people who don't, I want us to be able to construct a shared morality that both groups can embark on.
And what is it?
Well, I want to have it rooted in these human responses to people, their sympathy, respect for people, the sense of the sort of person we want to be. And I want to have it rooted in those things because I believe empirical study of the 20th century disasters suggests that what goes wrong happens because these things are eroded. I mean, for instance, if you take sympathy, sympathy is eroded by physical distance. We all remember the justifiable outrage that was caused when there were war crimes in Vietnam where villagers were bayoneted and shot. But what we need to remember also, I think, is that more or less every day, similar villages to that had bombs rained down on them which killed the same number of people. It's easier to kill people at a distance, and as a result, we're subject to a kind of cognitive illusion. Things we wouldn't do if we had to do them close up and see their consequences, we think are all right because they're at a distance and we don't feel it.
And yet, proximity doesn't save people from moral disaster either. I mean, the Rwandan massacre was basically face-to-face.
That's absolutely right. Sometimes the moral resources of sympathy and other things are overwhelmed by things like tribal hatred. In Rwanda, there was passionate propaganda against the other group, and as a result, people found it easy to do terrible things. There's also an excitement that people get out of participating in atrocities. There are accounts given by both American soldiers in Vietnam and Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan, which bear a striking similarity to each other, showing that people are, in certain ways, excited, get kind of drunk on tortures and horrors.
Yeah, you quote Vietnam warriors and very dramatically to that point. But I want you have, so you have reacquainted yourself with the moral horrors of the 20th century. I'd like you to sort of single out what for you are the emblematic ones and then trace the, as you do in your book, the ideas at the root of them.
Well, I think the Nazi one, although there's a great debate about whether Nazism was a unique horror, I think every event is in some ways unique and in some ways not unique. But I think the Nazi horror is a peculiar one because people, firstly, the victims, the Jews and others, were dehumanized by propaganda, which switched off sympathy. But then, even more, there was an ideology derived partly from Nietzsche, which said that there's a kind of heroism to overcoming the ordinary human feelings of sympathy, so that the SS were trained to regard themselves as more admirable when they did more horrible things. This was a kind of triumph over the weakness of the emotions. And in that way, I think it's psychologically a particularly extreme form.
Identify that for us. It's still, in a way, hard to reconstruct in our minds the vision of people believing and acting Nietzsche.
Well, I think the idea was that, I mean, Hitler himself was passionately anti-Christian. He said he was glad to see the end of what he called the Christian lie. And he wanted to throw out, he and the Nazis wanted to throw out the morality which Nietzsche himself had attacked in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the morality of sympathy, compassion for the weak. He thought that was sentimental nonsense. He was a social Darwinist. He believed that life was a struggle in which the strong win out, and the sign of strength was not being moved by what he thought of as sentimental compassion. Nietzsche said that one of the effects of Christianity and Judaism on the modern world was that what human beings who should be like proud, strong, free, wild animals had become measly domesticated animals. And Hitler very much took that idea on and wanted to push us back to being wild animals who won out in the struggle for existence.
Darwin escapes your sort of roll call of intellectual villains here, but not social Darwinism. I wish you'd sort of walk us through that idea.
Well, I don't want to criticize Darwin at all, because it seems to me that he was right in his account of human and other forms of evolution. But what the Nazis did was they took over, they were actually, I'm ashamed to say, English ideas, produced by someone called Houston Stuart Chamberlain, particularly, who went to Germany and had an enormous influence there. The belief was that the struggle for survival was a struggle between groups. It was a struggle between nations or races, and in that the strongest would win and the weakest would lose. There is something absurd, actually, about the Germans having taken on this idea, because they saw life, both just before the First World War, where these ideas were influential as well, and also in the Nazi period, they saw the struggle as being between Germany and France, Germany and Russia, Germany and England. But if they'd had these ideas about 100 years before, when Germany wasn't united, exactly the same ideas would have led to the belief in a struggle between Bavaria and Prussia, for instance. I mean, there's an arbitrariness to the units you take for this kind of theory. But once you've got it, it led them to believe, first, that you had to have this toughness in order to win out in the struggle, and second, that you had to go in for eugenics in order to improve the gene pool, in order to improve your own chances for survival. And the eugenic program, as we know, not only led to mad attempts to produce larger numbers of what they thought of were better children, and the hidden criterion, which they didn't state, always seems to me that the ideal person in the Nazi ideology was somebody who didn't look like Hitler.
The Black Book of Communism, which I'm sure you know, a sort of a French encyclopedia of communist slaughter, puts the figure at roughly 100 million people killed in the name of communism. This is something different.
Yes, I think communism was a matter of an extremely crude utilitarian approach to life. It wasn't what we think of as utilitarianism, a belief in happiness in a rather complicated way. It was a very crude idea that anything that furthered the revolution was justified, that morality, it was a belief system, really. It was a very powerful belief system. The idea that moral restraints were a sort of bourgeois illusion. Marx claimed to have explained away morality as having a class basis. It had no objectivity. It needn't be taken seriously because it was the product of a particular class outlook. And as a result, the indoctrination was that anything that furthered the revolution was justified. Mm. As we look back, it seems absurd because it's not at all obvious that any advantage was derived in terms of human consequences from the fact that so many people were sent off to Siberia and slaughtered.
1-800-423-8255 is the Moral History of the 20th Century connection phone with our guest Jonathan Glover. He's a philosopher, and his History of the 20th Century is really a search for philosophical ideas that made atrocity by the millions possible. 1-800-423-8255. I'm thinking of this as a kind of coda to a long nine-part series we did sort of introducing philosophical ideas during the summer. How did philosophical ideas shape the 20th century? Speak of another point. You and I welcome it, take a very tough moral line on the dropping of nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. What's the idea that justified that and still justifies it in popular American thinking and even in the very popular biography of Harry Truman?
Well, I think the idea that's supposed to justify it is that it saved more lives than it cost, allegedly, because it was thought that this was necessary to end the war. The claim was that the war wouldn't have ended without it. Many more lives would have been lost. Now, I dispute the claim that the war wouldn't have ended without it. There's already evidence that the Japanese were suing for peace. If the Allies had taken a slightly more subtle and sensitive response, if they, for instance, dropped the demand for unconditional surrender, which made the Japanese feel they were going to lose their emperor, which in fact they didn't after the war, I think it might have made it much easier for them to surrender. But I think it's not just the ideas that justified it. What seems to me fascinating about the dropping of the atomic bomb is that it illustrates one of the ways in which the sense of moral identity, the sense that I don't want to be the sort of person who participates in mass murder of civilians, that sense is eroded by the social and technological division of labor. Technology is so complicated, society is so complicated, that nobody feels responsible. I've been fascinated by the way in which, if you look at the scientists who produced the atomic bomb, they, on the whole, take the line, well, we didn't decide to drop it. We just produced it for society. We gave it to society. It was up to society what they did with it. If you look at the people in the military, the people who dropped the bomb, well, they were just obeying orders. Higher up, the generals would say, well, it was finally the president's decision. But I've been fascinated because I read Harry, I thought, well, it must be Harry Truman who took the decision. So he has a big volume of autobiography called 1945, and I would have thought that one of the big issues to be discussed there would be this decision in 1945. I discovered that only on one page, round about page 490, he discusses it for half a page, and what he says is, I was the person who took the decision about when and where it should be dropped. When and where, I thought to myself, what about whether it should be dropped? And it became clear that he thought that he'd handed that decision over to a thing called the Interim Committee, chaired by Henry Stimson, the Secretary of State. So I thought, well, they must have decided. I then read an interview with Robert Oppenheimer, who was on that committee, and he said, oh, no, we didn't think we were deciding. We thought the politicians had already decided that, and we were just giving technical advice. And one of the horrifying things I think about this major moral decision in the middle of the 20th century is that the closer one looks, the harder it is to find anyone who actually thought they were deciding.
You talk about tribalism, too. I mean, you talk about tribalism, but when you think of the Balkans in the 1990s, when you think of Rwanda, when you think of Northern Ireland, this is still a very real motive in the picture we have of the 20th century in general. How do you explain it?
I think it has very deep roots in human psychology, such that it's not at all clear we can eliminate tribalism. The optimistic thinkers of the 18th century Enlightenment thought that we would all become world citizens and stop feeling our sense of tribe. It's so clear that this, so far at least, hasn't happened. My belief is that we have this very strong tribal sense, partly because it's bound up with our own sense of our own personal identity. We get our sense of our identity from the community in which we live, the language we speak, the places which are familiar to us. And because of the role they play in our identity, together with the historical stories we tend to be told, and particularly in these places like Yugoslavia and Ireland, there are always these stories about the history, always in which our side has been one way or another trampled on or betrayed by the other groups. And these stay very alive. The German poet Schiller had the idea that nationalism was a kind of bent twig. As you walk through the woods with small, thin branches on trees, as you walk through, they flip back. And if you're the second person walking in the line, you keep getting hit by the twigs. Nationalism is often like that. People who feel humiliated, feel that their group has been oppressed or not allowed freedom, have a passionate resentment which comes out. So you often get a spiral of vendetta, as between Serbs and Croats, or as between the two communities in Northern Ireland, where each side has a long historical story to tell about oppression and cruelty by the other side.
1-800-423-8255. The philosopher Jonathan Glover is our guest. His book is called Humanity, as in Rescuing It in a New Century. The subtitle is A Moral History of the 20th Century. 1-800-423-TALK. Ajmal is on the line from Hampton, Virginia.
Hi.
Welcome.
I may have a very naive question, but I was trying to formulate morality as compared in the free enterprise system compared to a socialist or communist theology. And my simplistic answer seems to be that morality seems to be better justified in the socialist or communist outlook simply for the reason of a larger larger ring of support for the downtrodden, at least on theory. In practice, it may be different, but on the free enterprise system, the individual's pursuit for incentive to perform is so high that the downtrodden or the people who cannot participate may end up in a very, very bad situation. Could you explain that to me, if possible?
I think that's a very interesting question. What I want to say about it is that I think that different parts of morality fit better into socialist and capitalist outlooks. Socialists have, as you rightly say, been much stronger on the whole on justice for the downtrodden than people who believe in capitalism. But equally, I think people who believe in capitalism have been much stronger about freedom, which I count as morality, individual rights, than people who believe in socialism. I mean, my own view is that while socialism has been shown to be manifestly a disaster as tried in practice, I'm not quite so impressed as many people are by capitalism in practice either, as I think that if one looks at the enormous numbers of people in the world, particularly, say, in Africa, who don't have clean water to drink, don't have absolutely basic medical attention, don't have enough food to eat, I think it's too early to be quite as triumphal about capitalism and morality as some people are. I think we need to work out a new morality that isn't quite capitalist, isn't quite socialist.
I think you're quite correct. In the same token, the example to me is what is happening in China as opposed to what's called Russia now, where China is continuing with some kind of doctrinaire and autocratic regime, but providing much better, I think, to the humanity it has as what Russia is doing. Any comment? I'll take it off the air.
Well,
Ashmal, thank you.
My comment would simply be that I wouldn't take either current Russia or past Russia or current China as my model. They both seem to me to have such huge defects. One is hopelessly inefficiently run. The other is hopelessly authoritarian and denies people freedom.
What is your model between you give capitalism points for freedom, but you take points off for the sort of competitive greed. Socialism gets points for egalitarian concern for the other, but loses points for freedom. What is the model?
What I would like to see, I mean, I had rather hoped that at the end of the Cold War, there would be what the Italians called the historic compromise, where you try to take the best from both. I mean, I think that a system which involves free state-provided medical care, for instance, has a great deal to be said for it. On the other hand, the state running and controlling all industries, as they did in the old Eastern Europe, was manifestly a disaster. I think we need a lot more experimentation, but I do very much look for a sort of, as it were, Western European middle way between the extremes of free enterprise and the extremes of socialism.
1-800-423-8255. The moral history of the 20th century as a philosophical problem. Marcus is on the line.
Good morning. Another fascinating program. I can't wait to read this book. My question, just listening to you, Mr. or Dr. Glover, I'm not sure which it is, it strikes me that the regimes which are undemocratic, wherever they're found, seem to breed the immorality and the atrocities, whereas democratically elected governments seem to have almost a built-in restraint of being removed from power by the ballot box. How does that play into the history?
For me, that's extremely important. I absolutely agree that the check on government provided by the possibility of removing them seems to me an absolutely essential precondition of a politically decent society. But I think one should remember, all the same, that Hitler won a free election. I mean, he didn't allow free elections after that, but he did actually win an election. And so I want to say that democracy is possibly a necessary condition of a politically good society, but not necessarily a sufficient one. We need more than just democracy. We need a certain kind of moral outlook as well.
Marcus,
I would point out to you, though, that Hitler might have won a free election, and he also had legislation which put the state imprimatur on everything that he did, but it wasn't really a free society, so you can't really compare it, in my view.
No, absolutely. I'm not for a minute trying to say Hitler had a free and democratic society. I'm saying he won an election in one and then wrecked the free and democratic society, replacing it by a particularly horrible dictatorship.
Thank you.
Marcus, thank you. You make a sort of European middle way your model. I'd love you to sort of sharpen that. Another way of asking it is, how did you score as a moral matter the war in the Balkans last year?
Well, I have to say that as a European, I am not the least proud of what happened in the Balkans over the last 10 years. But the issue of the Kosovo intervention, I found myself very torn by, because on the one hand, the lessons are that people go to war much too readily. On the other hand, though, we in the past have stood by and allowed horrible things to happen, as in the case where the Allies allowed Hitler to get away with a great deal before he was finally stopped. Very, very reluctantly, I found myself supporting the Kosovo intervention because I believed that many Albanians were being massacred. Milosevic had already invaded two other countries in what used to be Yugoslavia. It seemed to me time to stop him. But I do want to say that...
Hold the thought, and we'll pick it up after the break. We're talking with Jonathan Glover about his book, Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Jonathan Glover, is a philosopher in London. His book, titled Humanity, is a wonderfully written distillation, not just of the history of the 20th century, but the ideas, the moral riddles, the moral failures, the moral reflections that marked it. We're talking about a century in which millions of people rose above the impulse to do the right thing. And the question is why. We were speaking about the Kosovo intervention as sort of NATO, the West's effort to sort of start again on some of the same questions. In what way was it a redemptive intervention? In what way wasn't it?
Well, I want to say that I very reluctantly, I decided that I thought it was justified. I'm always very reluctant to go to war because people do so often without good reason. But it did seem to me that there were lots of people among the Albanians who had been driven out of their homes, killed, persecuted, and that it was necessary to use force because persuasion didn't seem to work with Milosevic. But having said that, that's the case for it. The side of it which worries me is that I want to see a proper world police force, which the UN is supposed to be.
This is what we need more than anything, you say.
Well, yes, because I don't think... You see, NATO did that. Nobody appointed NATO to be world policeman. And so there's a real question about the moral authority.
The United Nations didn't endorse it either.
No, and so I think there's a real question about the moral authority of a group of strong people. People often say we now live in a global village, but we don't live in a properly policed global villages. Villages come in two kinds. There's one kind of village in some countries where if somebody attacks somebody else, you call the police, they come, and there's proper legal enforcement. In other kinds of villages, in other countries, you have to round up a posse of strong, powerful neighbours to go and beat up the person who's doing it. I want us to move from the second kind of village to the first, and that means having a proper world court that authorises intervention, a properly funded and properly militarily equipped United Nations police force, and clear criteria about what justifies intervention. Because at the moment, it still looks like the law of the jungle, with just the strongest people policing that jungle.
Through a pretty terrifying century, you find there are a sort of exceptional models of a better way, and one of them that you write about persuasively is the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, which ended in a kind of mutual retreat and, as you say, Kennedy's deception and Khrushchev's climb down are not the stuff of conventional heroism, but in the nuclear age, such heroism is outdated. Though through climb down and deception, they avoided war. After the crisis, Khrushchev wrote to Kennedy that we had to step over our pride, both you and we, in order to reach this agreement. This stepping over pride is what the statesmen of 1914 had not been able to do to their sense of national honor. What's the model there?
Well, what I think was fantastic about the Cuban Missile Crisis is that it started so badly. Khrushchev took the rash gamble of putting missiles in Cuba. Kennedy's first reaction was anger, and there was a great deal of talk about military intervention. We now realize how incredibly dangerous that crisis was, because we now know there were nuclear weapons in Cuba, not under proper control of the Soviet Union, so that any military invasion by the United States could have triggered nuclear war. What I think is fantastic about that crisis is, first, the letters from Khrushchev, in which he shows that he remembers the horrors of war. He wrote some highly personal, very emotional letters to Kennedy about the importance of not pulling on the rope so that the knot became impossible to untie. I think it's also fantastic that Kennedy... Two things were, I thought, really great about Kennedy, and I know Kennedy is somewhat out of fashion these days, but I still think of him as one of the great American presidents, mainly because of what he did in this crisis. First, he had the imagination to see vividly what the horror of nuclear war would be. He and a group of others in his government had been to a special class in which they'd gone through all the details of what nuclear bombs actually do in detail, and he had the imagination to see how terrible that was, where many of his advisers thought it might be worth risking that war. And the other thing was that he gave Khrushchev room to back down without humiliation. He was prepared to leave Khrushchev an exit so that he didn't just have to grovel and retreat. And that seemed to me fantastic, because it put avoiding the ultimate catastrophe before everything else.
The other rather sort of sanitary thread in your book is a notion that the moral impulse is something that is built into us, is built into children. In what sense does that sort of encourage us about the future?
Well, I think both adults and children have built into them conflicting tendencies. We have a tendency to cruelty. We all know children bully each other in schools. We all know that adults are horrible to each other in the ways the 20th century has made very vivid. But also, we do care about each other. There are resources of sympathy we can draw on. There are ways in which we are, for instance, disgusted if someone is humiliated, if someone humiliates a blind beggar by taking their money or insulting them. We hate that. We have tendencies both ways. I think the role of upbringing can't be exaggerated. One of the lessons, which I think is very interesting, which comes from the Nazi experience, the psychoanalyst Alice Miller once wrote that she'd studied the upbringings of all the leading Nazis and couldn't find a single one who hadn't had an authoritarian upbringing. This is certainly true of Hitler. He was savagely beaten frequently by his father. On the other hand, there are some psychologists, American psychologists, Samuel and Pearl Oliner, who've done a study of those in Poland who rescued Jews in the Nazi period and those who didn't. And the contrast they find a number of contrasts, but one really interesting one is about the difference in upbringing. That the ones who didn't rescue were given the traditional authoritarian upbringing, where everything was discipline, everything was obedience. The ones who were rescuers were ones who'd been encouraged to think things out for themselves about morality and been encouraged to base it on sympathy and concern for other people. And that isn't deeply surprising, but the fact that it is so visible in that case makes me think that there is real hope for us in making a better world if we try to bring up our children in the way that the rescuers were brought up. The other thing is, of course, it can seem absurd to say, if you're talking about bringing up children, do we want to base everything on avoiding atrocities? For most people, becoming a concentration camp commander isn't a real option. We don't want to base everything on that. But luckily, the kind of upbringing that helps guard against that is also the kind of upbringing that's useful in everyday moral life.
Well, let's hope. 1-800-423-8255 makes the humanity connection with the philosopher Jonathan Glover. Edward is calling from Braintree, Massachusetts.
Good morning.
Morning, Edward.
Somewhere I read a figure of about state-sponsored terrorism in this century, and I believe it was 120 million or more had been killed. You know, 63 by Stalin, 30 million by Mao, 12 by Hitler. You have your Idi Amin, you have the situation in Uganda, you have the Armenians. And I'm wondering if the problem is that we just have an evil nature. I believe that Arnold Toynbee mentioned that, that there's just something innately evil within us. And I guess I'm not a Calvinist to believe that we're only evil, because I think we both have the devil and the angel in us. But what do you think of that?
Well, I think we have tendencies which, unchecked, may lead us into doing things that are called evil. I find evil not a very helpful psychological concept. I think it's a moral judgment, the term of moral judgment, which we don't want to give up. I mean, I want to be able to say that what Idi Amin did, what Saddam Hussein did, what Hitler did were evil. I want to be able to say that. That's making a moral judgment. But in terms of explaining why people do these things, I think we need a more complex psychology. Instead of saying it's an evil side of our nature, I think we need to start asking, what is it? There is a love of cruelty in many people, which is potentially there. There is a tribalism which leads people to hatred. There is too great a willingness to obey and to conform. There's the possibility of switching off sympathy and concern for other people. But I think we need to spell it out in some detail like that, and then look at the countervailing tendencies. I don't want to say that people are fundamentally evil or that they're fundamentally good. We have tendencies that pull us in both directions. And once we become aware of that, we can start shaping ourselves. We can start encouraging some tendencies in ourselves and in our children and discouraging others.
Edward, do you want a last word?
Do we individually have a basic selfishness that can carry over into something horrific as a group?
Yes, we do have a basic selfishness, but we also have a basic altruism. People often do selfish things, but often also they risk their lives to rescue others. And what we need to understand more about is, under what circumstances does one dominate and under what circumstances does another?
You include in the book that wonderful Seamus Heaney story, a sort of moral anecdote. Do you want to tell it?
Well, Seamus Heaney tells a story in the lecture he gave when
he got
the Nobel Prize for Poetry. And there was he talks, his poetry is wonderfully engaged with the horrors of the conflict in Northern Ireland. And he's someone who takes sides, he's on the nationalist side, but he also has the generosity and imagination to see the roots of the conflict and to understand a lot about the other side too. He talks about a terrible event that happened. There was a busload of workers being driven back one evening from a factory to their homes, and they were stopped by some armed men who were masked. And everybody was ordered to get out. And somebody said, all Catholics should step out in front. And it was assumed that these were Protestant terrorists who were going to kill the Catholics. Though, as it happened, nearly everybody was Protestant. There was only one Catholic. And he was torn between wanting to be loyal to his religion, not to deny it, and so to step out, but at the same time wanting to save his life and wanting to keep quiet about it. And the Protestant man next to him touched his hand in a gesture which said, there's no need, no one will tell on you, there's no need to step out, you're safe here with friends. But it was too late, he did step out. After he stepped out, the guns opened up and killed all the Protestants. It turned out it was Catholic terrorists. And it was this is a horrible, horrible story, because nearly all of them were killed. But in a way, the one, I can't say redeeming feature, because nothing can redeem that horrible atrocity, but the one nearly redeeming feature is that the gesture of friendship across the divide between the communities by the single Protestant man is known about, and known about presumably only could be known about through the word of the Catholic man he tried to save. And what I want to say about that is that every time people make that kind of gesture across the community barriers, it helps break down the hostile stereotypes. It reminds people that there are on both sides people who put humanity before tribalism.
That story gives me goosebumps. When I first heard it from Seamus Heaney, when I read it in your book, and now to hear you tell it again, it's one of the terrific sort of little bits, promising bits. It's a terrible way to learn a truth, but it's an important truth for the 21st century. 1-800-423-8255, the Humanity Connection. George is in Buffalo, New York.
Hello.
Welcome, George.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you, very much. Another extraordinarily pertinent subject. Of those psychologists, sir, that you discussed trying to examine this subject, you did, there was one conspicuous omission, and I thought that was the work of Stanley Milgram, whose work has been disturbing to me ever since I first encountered it. And I'm sure you're familiar with it. Would you please give me...
This is the psychologist at Yale?
Yes, the studies of
torture?
Obedience.
Who would object to torture? To inflicting torture and pain?
Yes, exactly. Testing. I'm sure that you're both aware of the fact that most social scientists interviewed drastically underestimated the number of people that would behave in a reprehensible way, really. And how do you account for such apparently inhuman behavior among apparently very human people?
Stanley Milgram's experiments, I think, are absolutely fascinating and of enormous importance for understanding these issues. He showed that people ordered by a laboratory scientist in a white coat would be prepared to do something which they believed, as it happened wrongly, would be administering shocks, electric shocks, to people in a supposed psychology experiment. And the shocks were of varying degrees of severity. And horrifyingly large numbers of people were prepared to administer shocks, what they thought were these shocks, right up to amazingly high, dangerous levels of shock under orders. I think that the lesson of that is that the Eichmann-like obedience is not confined to Nazi Germany. It's a human disposition which people in New Haven, Connecticut, were able to do. Decent, good people, good family people, were somehow tricked by the fact that it was obeying orders. One of the lessons we need to take away is that the capacity for obedience that humans have is possibly one of our Achilles' heels. And all sorts of things need obedience. I mean, I'm very glad that when my aircraft landed at Boston last night, the people in air traffic control didn't have a big debate about what to do when somebody gave the orders as to where people landed. In all sorts of ways in modern society, we need obedience. But I think red lights ought to flash when we're ordered to do something which seems pretty terrible, and we're inclined to do it because of this deep impulse to obey. It's a very dangerous impulse indeed.
George, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Tatiana is on the line.
Hello. I would like to say that I'm looking forward to the book of your distinguished guest tonight, today, I should say. But I have a question and rather a comment. I don't know if Andrei Sakharov at all comes up in the book that we're discussing right now on morality, but that's an interesting concept, that in the complex times that we live now in, especially in the post-Second World War, rather ethics is probably the only we can have in conversations, because in the end it also proves to be the most pragmatic thing to do. And also I'd like to ask a question. Where does, if it does at all, the so-called politics of truth come into the concept of the morality that your guest has spoken so eloquently and so much that I can agree with?
Give me a chance to answer. You're asking about the politics of truth, but also the example of Andrei Sakharov.
Yes, I do in my book talk a bit about Andrei Sakharov, who seems to me an admirable example of someone who was prepared to, in dangerous circumstances, go for truth in a way that mattered enormously. I have a chapter about the Stalinist abandonment of the idea of objective truth. It seems to be one of the deep dangers of Marxist theory, which was then exhibited very vividly in Stalin's time, is the idea that all thinking is somehow class-based, biased in one way or another, and as a result we should give up the idea that there is such a thing as an objective truth. That became extraordinarily dangerous because it allowed people to put out any old propaganda they liked and as a result defend their system of beliefs rather than seeing that things were going wrong. George Orwell has a very nice thing he says about objective truth. He was in the Spanish Civil War fighting against the fascists, and he read an account afterwards which said that there was a very large Russian army in Spain of a million people, I think, something of that sort. And Orwell knew that there wasn't. And he said that what was worrying to him was that whichever side won, one set of lies or another would become entrenched. And he began to worry that the very idea of objective truth was fading from the world, and that frightened him much more than bombs. I don't know that it frightens me much more than bombs, but certainly it seems to me an alarming tendency. It seems to me that the politics of truth is an extremely important part of our defense against atrocities.
Tatiana, thank you for the question. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. Lou is on the line.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity, Christopher, to talk to you and your guest this morning.
Welcome.
The thing that struck me most about the past century relative to objective reality was when the American soldiers liberated some of the concentration camps. They were shocked at how many SS people were shocked that the Americans weren't going to continue their work, the work of these horrible crimes.
Wait now, you get several shocks there.
Okay.
Americans shocked that the SS were shocked?
Yeah, I'll try to shrink it to one. The SS was shocked that the Americans weren't going to continue their work because they so believed that these horrible crimes, they so believed that what they were doing was right in spite of these horrible crimes, okay? And this struck me, because I've been reading something about one of my favorite philosophers who spoke of all of creation being covered by law, not a square inch uncovered. And it struck me that if we're not rooted in unchanging principle, that the human mind can go anywhere. It can believe that these horrendous crimes are right and possibly even believe that great things are wrong. And I wanted to ask your guest what he thought about that.
Well, I agree that the SS people did believe passionately that what they were doing was right. There are some horrifying things that Himmler and the other members of the SS said about how they were acting in a way that was morally admirable, that they hadn't lost their soul despite having to do disgusting, dirty work, which was all justified by their particular morality. That, to me, shows the dangers of a belief system held to fanatically and held to without testing it against the human responses of sympathy and concern for other people. But I think there are problems. You say that isn't there a danger that we'll believe anything if we don't believe there's an objective set of moral principles? I think there is such a danger, but there are huge problems in establishing what are the objective moral principles. There are huge problems in deciding which version of religion is true, if any. There are huge problems in deciding what the rational basis for ethics is if we don't have a religious morality. And what I want to work on is something which I believe to be very widespread, which is I think many, many more people would agree that what the Nazis did was utterly unspeakable and could not be justified, than would agree on some set of abstract principles that might be used to argue against them. I remember a philosopher in the 19th century once said that he was far more certain that there was an objectively existing physical world than he was certain of the validity of any philosophical argument against it. And that's a bit what I feel about ethics. I'm far more certain that what the Nazis did was unspeakable and should never be repeated than I am about the validity of some abstract principle which I've tried to work out as a philosopher. And I believe that's fairly widespread. And so if we start with what we actually do agree about, most of us, the horrors of these atrocities, let's then try to build up a morality which will prevent that sort of thing from happening again.
Is that the answer to Nietzsche?
I would like it to be.
Jonathan Glover, thank you enormously for the book, for joining us, for bearing with our questions. Connection listeners, if you're anywhere around Boston tonight, Wednesday, the 13th of September, Jonathan Glover will be speaking at the Kennedy School's Wiener Auditorium at 6 p.m. You can also continue the conversation on humanity and the 20th century on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thank you, Jonathan Glover. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Bicon Dental Implants, providing patients an alternative to root canal surgery since 1985. Available worldwide and at the Implant Dentistry Center at Faulkner Hospital, 524-3900. By Boston University.